Live from New York City, it's The Gary Null Show. And now, your host, Gary Null.
Hi, everyone. I'm Gary Null. And this is an original, in-depth investigative report on the JFK assassination. This is in six series. First up, the life and assassination of JFK's mistress, Mary Meyer. My guest is Peter Janney. He is the son of the senior career CIA officer, Y-Star Janney, and his family was intimately involved with many of Washington's social and political elite, including the family of high CIA official Cord Meyer, whose wife Mary, a Penichet Meyer, would become President John F. Kennedy's mistress and close confidant. Janney himself was best friends with one of Meyer's sons and knew the Meyer family personally. Mary would later be found murdered in a park near Georgetown in Washington, D.C., 11 months after the JFK assassination. In 1992, Janney met Leo Damor, an author researching Mary Meyer and the controversy surrounding her unsolved death. Damor committed suicide under mysterious circumstances in 1995, his book never completed. Peter continued Danmore's research and his personal leads after acquiring the late author's files. Peter's book, Mary Mosaic, The CIA Conspiracy to Murder John F. Kennedy, Mary Penichet Meyer, and Their Vision for World Peace, reveals previously unknown information about the CIA's role in the Kennedy's death and the murder of the woman who JFK wanted to divorce Jackie for. Peter graduated from Princeton University, received a doctorate in psychology from Boston University, an MBA from Duke University, and has a psychological practice in Boston. His website is marysmosaic.net. Nice to have you with us today, Peter.
Good afternoon, Gary, and thank you very much for having me today.
Peter, it's going to be pieces of a puzzle put together one at a time, and the way that I always do my discussions with people is first begin with the most important pieces, give us the story and the context behind them, and most importantly, any hard prima facie evidence that can support your contentions. As you know, there's more than 2,000 books written on the JFK assassination. There's been a lot of different theories. We spent 9 months before deciding who would end up in our particular series based upon our independent ability to verify their facts. But they all had something in common. They all led back to some central characters, including who would have had the capacity to have covered it up. Clearly anyone is going to assassinate the most powerful person in the world would realize that you'd have the Secret Service, the FBI, the National Security Agency, the CIA, all doing in-depth research, as well as major media. How could you get around those unless you had co-opted them or unless they had been a part of it? You also had so many people who were mysteriously dying right after, let's say, within 24 months of the Kennedy assassination, and even those dying before they had a chance to testify before the Warren Commission. And what role did they actually play? So we're going to ask you to take each piece of this, including one of the most important ones, the evidence that John F. Kennedy, after he left the White House, wanted to marry Mary Meyer and divorce Jackie Kennedy. What proof do we have of that? We're going to get into that. And also, we intend, during this series, to identify the three shooters by name and how we can prove that they were the shooters. So let's start on this in a conversation with attorney William Pepper, who, for listeners, was the last attorney to defend and try to prove the innocence of James Earl Ray in the murder of Martin Luther King Jr. and Sirhan Sirhan's assassination of Robert Kennedy. William Pepper said he believed that the murder of John F. Kennedy's mistress, Mary Meyer, is perhaps the most important post-JFK assassination murder that needs to come to the public in greater detail. And since you were Mary Meyer's son's best friend growing up, and when she was married to the top CIA official, Cord Meyer, who we will get to later, You have undertaken extensive research and investigation into Mary Myers' life, her relationship with John F. Kennedy, and identified firsthand her likely assassin in the covert CIA operations. So please take your time. You won't be interrupted. I want you to speak about who Mary Meyer was, the type of person she was, her lifelong devotion to world peace, the special relationship she had with Kennedy, not simply as another one of his dozens of sexual conquests, but as a true love and a confidant, because it appears that Kennedy developed a deep respect for her insights and sought her consultation for dealing with the mindset of the Cold War hawks in Washington, who were obstacles to Kennedy's later ambitions to change the culture of aggression and tension between U.S., Soviet Union, and Cuba. She also seemed to represent a new generation of values that would later burst forth in the late 1960s. And then how close was this Meyer-Kennedy relationship? And what do you believe was the practical impact Mary had on Kennedy? So take your time and paint a detailed portrait of this woman as you knew her from her your own conversations and research.
Wow. Okay. Well, let's begin. You know, I think I come to this subject matter not only about Mary Meyer, but about the Kennedy assassination from a little different vantage point than a lot of other authors. And by that I mean, you know, I grew up with the CIA. My father was a high-level career official right at the top. He was recruited by Allen Dulles in 1948. He was there at the beginning. And so all through the 1950s, 1960s, I was, of course, living with my family in Washington, and they had active social lives with other top members of the agency, the Meyer family for sure, Tracy Barnes, Jim Angleton, Desmond Fitzgerald. So I knew these families. I knew their children. I grew up with them. And, of course, at a very early age, I knew Michael Meyer, who was the middle Meyer child. He and I were just bosom buddies starting at about the age of five or six. And we went to school together, we played together, we hung out at each other's houses. My mother had gone to Vassar College, was in the same class as Mary Pinchot Meyer, the class of 1942. And, of course, my father and Cord Meyer were colleagues at the CIA and very close friends. So when Michael was killed when we were 9 years old, he was, you know, it was an accident. He was hit by a car and killed in December of 1956. And this was a very traumatic event for me. And it was at this point, Gary, that my relationship with Mary Meyer changed dramatically. Before, she had been my best friend's mother. And I knew her. I liked being around her. She was like no other adult in my parents' generation. She was arguably one of the most beautiful women of an entire generation. But after Michael's death, I grew very closer to Mary in particular because she was the only adult who really could reach me in terms of helping me cope with my grief. And my grief was very intense. You know, both my parents were active alcoholics, as were a lot of people in that era. And they weren't really equipped, in my, you know, opinion, when I look back this nowadays, and also from the vantage point of being a clinical psychologist, they weren't equipped to really give me what Mary Meyer was able to give me. So my relationship with her didn't end at Michael's death. It actually got a little bit stronger. And I also kept in touch with the two other Meyer children, Quentin, who was a year older, Mark, who was a couple of years younger. And most of us, of course, being from sort of these elite aristocratic families in Washington, we were sent off to boarding school during our high school years. And in the fall of 1964, I was away at boarding school, and I did not even know about Mary Meyer's murder until I came home for Thanksgiving in November of 64. And it was just, you know, almost casually talked about at the dinner table the night before Thanksgiving, and it really sent me into shivers that night. I write about this in the book. I don't want to ruin it for your readers, just to say it was kind of a dark night of the soul experience for me. And I knew something was wrong. I didn't know what it was, but I was just, again, shattered that this woman had been indiscriminately murdered in cold blood on the C&O Canal towpath as she strolled each day after, you know, working as a painter. So I, you know, buckled up, you know, went back to school, started to live my life. But it was then in the beginning of 1976 when the world first learned of this article in the National Enquirer that Mary Meyer had had an affair with President Kennedy for the last few years of his life. And none of us, except for, you know, the sort of small elite group of Mary's friends, had known about this affair. And so when this came out in 1976, it really disturbed me again. I mean, it sort of resurrected my anxiety, it resurrected my grief, and I really began to suspect that there might be some possible connection between JFK's assassination and Mary Meyer's murder, which occurred just less than a year after JFK had been assassinated in Dallas in 1963. So already by that time, Gary, my relationship with my father had pretty much deteriorated. I was an ardent anti-war, anti-Vietnam War protester in the late 60s. I think it was very, very difficult for my family to, in a sense, understand what was going on there. And like many of the people in my generation, I was getting arrested at demonstrations, and this was kind of an embarrassment for, you know, a rather prominent social family in Washington, D.C. But be that as it may, you know, there were a number of very vociferous encounters between my father and I about Vietnam and a number of other things in the late 60s. But it wasn't until 1967 that I brought up to my father for discussion, you know, what this guy Jim Garrison was doing in New Orleans in terms of bringing this case against Clay Shaw and in a sense accusing the CIA of having masterminded what had taken place in Dallas. And I sort of casually one day brought this to my father's attention because I just wanted to see if we could talk about it. And he immediately became apoplectic that I would even bring up such a thing. He was very upset. And of course, what I didn't know at the time, and I subsequently found out through, you know, documents that were released to the National Archives, is that my father was chairing these very high-level meetings within the CIA where they were talking about Jim Garrison, and they were very worried as soon as September of 1967 that Garrison was going to get a conviction of this guy Clay Shaw. They thought this was likely going to take place because, of course, they knew Clay Shaw had been a CIA asset, even though Garrison hadn't been able to prove it yet. So already the CIA is hunkering down in 1967, trying to figure out what they're going to do. And, of course, they did finally employ a number of dirty tricks that sabotaged Garrison's investigation to one degree or another and sabotaged the trial. And, of course, it didn't come out until many years later where Richard Helms of the CIA had to admit that Clay Shaw had, in fact, been working for the CIA at one time. So, you know, this was just another nail in the coffin, from my point of view, about what my father was really up to. And this is, you know, I think the problem of many of us first-generation CIA brats. You know, St. John Hunt, I've talked to him, had some communication with him, I think, you know, and a few other children of that age. I mean, we've all had to reckon with the fact that in some way we really didn't ever have the opportunity of knowing who our fathers were. In my case, and in, you know, a number of other cases, the alcoholism part or dimension of our relationships also played a significant part in terms of just making relationship in general very difficult to sustain. So,
Peter, I'd like to jump ahead here. You've given us a pretty clear understanding of your motivations, your association with Mary Meyer, her family, your father letting you, your father being angry at you when you asked just a very simple question, and finding out your father actually headed a top CIA committee that was meant to monitor and ultimately infiltrate and sabotage Jim Garrison's investigation of Clay Shaw, who played an instrumental role in the assassination, and all the other people around Clay Shaw had been murdered. You know, look at Ferry. He had been murdered. Look at Guy Bannister. He had been murdered. All these people were dying, and it wasn't by accident. In any case, I interviewed Garrison at length, and James Garrison told me in about 12 hours of interviews that the FBI, the CIA, they were all infiltrating, wiretapping his office, his home, and he knew that he had very little chance of making a case, and they were going to try to paint him as a conspiratorial nutjob. But this jumps forward. We have to jump forward to where we learn more about Mary and why she would have been a threat. Just being a mistress of a president doesn't make you a threat. Why was she then considered a threat? What did she know that would have put her in a position of someone deciding we have to take her out?
I can answer that very quickly and very explicitly. Mary Meyer became a threat because after JFK's assassination, she was, of course, grief-stricken. She was very upset by this, and she decided to devote right then and there a significant portion of her life and recorded much of what she was finding out in her diary, what had really taken place in Dallas on November 22nd. And given her stature within Washington, she had a lot of access. She talked to Kenny O'Donnell, I believe she probably talked to Dave Powers, both of whom had been riding in the next car behind the president's car in the Dallas motorcade, and both of whom were convinced, as two World War II combat veterans, that two shots had at least come from the grassy knoll, from the front and to the right of the motorcade. And, of course, that account is recounted in Tip O'Neill's book, Man of the House. So Mary knew, of course, Kenny O'Donnell because she was actually a pretty permanent fixture in the White House the last year and a half of JFK's presidency. That's pretty well acknowledged, and the author Nina Burley did an interview with White House counsel who testified to that effect. So Mary was very, very upset when the Warren Commission came out, and she realized the extent of the conspiracy, the second conspiracy, to cover up what had happened in Dallas. And she decided that she was going to go public, that she was going to stand up and tell people what she knew and what she had found out. And, of course, what she had found out led right to the front and back door of the CIA, which would have implicated her ex-husband, Cord Meyer, as well as his best friend and close colleague, James Jesus Angleton, who happened to be a family friend and also the godfather to the remaining two children, to Meyer children. So this is why they had to eliminate her. In the same way, I believe they also eliminated Philip Graham, who was head of the Washington Post. Although everyone would like us to believe that Philip Graham shot himself in a suicide, I think it's pretty clear from some of the evidence I bring up in my book that was not, in fact, the case. Philip Graham was taken out because he was no longer the supporter of the CIA that he had once been. And had he been alive in November, having allegedly committed suicide in August of 63, he certainly would have come to Mary Meyer's defense. They were close friends. They knew each other quite well. And, of course, Mr. Graham was still had quite a bit of control in the Washington Post. And the CIA needed the media in a really big way to keep this conspiracy clamped down. And that, Gary, in my opinion, was why they had to take not only Mary Meyer out, but a number of other people. They could not risk people in the know talking about what they knew.
But that doesn't tell us what they knew. That only gives you a supposition, a subjective supposition. We have to know, what did Mary Meyer know? What could have caused such embarrassment to have undermined the Warren Commission? Do you have any evidence, any insights, any information that would have led us to say, wow, now we know why she was killed?
Well, I don't have any smoking gun, per se. I have what you might would call circumstantial or anecdotal evidence, just in terms of the people who knew her, the closest people, like her best friend, Ann Truitt. Ann Truitt told her son, Sam Truitt, that she believed that Mary had been killed because she was doing too much poking around with the assassination. Ann Truitt talked to Cord Meyer shortly before his death, and Cord Meyer admitted to Ann Truitt that Ray Crump...
Who? Okay, getting back.
Told Ann Truitt that Ray Crump did not kill Mary. You know, there's nothing, and of course, Angleton, I believe, absconded with Mary's diary, either, you know, out of the studio the night of her murder or out of her bedroom from her house on the night of the murder. So even though that's where the repository of Mary's information would have been.
Okay, let's go to, I need short answers to get through all of our discussion points. Who was accused of killing her? What were the circumstances of that murder?
Well, the person who was accused of killing her was this downtrodden African-American laborer, Ray Crump, who happened to be in the general vicinity of where the murder took place because he was down there with his girlfriend having a little tryst. And Crump was arrested. He wasn't even near the murder scene when he was arrested. About 45 minutes after the murder had taken place, he was, you know, drunk, and they used him as a patsy. He was subsequently framed the next day by this Army Lieutenant William L. Mitchell, who I write about in my book. And I believe Mitchell, although he wasn't the actual assassin in the Mary Meyer murder, was part of the assassination team that was working that day to pull this off.
Prove it. Make your case.
Well, I can only prove it in the sense that, first of all, we cannot locate Mr. Mitchell's service record. The National Personnel Record Center says he doesn't exist, when in fact we have the evidence that he was at Cornell University in the Army ROTC program. He was a distinguished military student. Mitchell himself has admitted that he was in the United States Army in 64 and 63 to 65. And yet his record has vanished. So that's highly suspicious. Mitchell still contends that this is just a mistake. I've actually brought an action against Mitchell in a civil lawsuit in Washington, D.C. for the murder of Mary Meyer. And there are certain details about this case I can't talk to you at the moment about, but it's ongoing, and it will probably get resolved sometime in early next year.
But why would you accuse him? Of all the people you could accuse, give us the basis of information that led to you believing that he was one of the shooters, or involved at least in her assassination.
Okay, I don't think he was one of the shooters, because there was only one shooter. I do think he was part of the team on the towpath that day to, in a sense, bring this operation off. You have to understand that this, in an operation such as this, where you're trying to use a patsy and you're trying to make it look like a random act of violence, it takes a lot of planning, a lot of logistical planning, technical planning to pull this off. And there were several people on the towpath that come up in the court transcript that I believe were spotters for watching where Mary was, and then when she walked into the particular area, which I designate as the kill zone, that's when she was taken out. And Mitchell presents himself as just a runner on the towpath that day, and he shows up at the police department the day after the murder and has an interview with a policeman there, and he says, you know, I think I ran by that woman right before she was murdered. It must have been. And, oh, by the way, there was this black guy following her, and then he reels off a description of, you know, what the black guy was wearing, which was exactly or very close to what Ray Crump was wearing. And this is how they start to frame the case to make it look like Ray Crump was the actual murderer, when in fact there wasn't a shred of forensic evidence linking Ray Crump to the body of Mary Meyer or the crime scene whatsoever.
What happened to Ray Crump?
Well, what happened is that he was acquitted. He was arrested that day. He was kept in jail for 9 months, where he was abused. He was possibly raped and of course, severely traumatized by what had taken place. He had a legendary attorney by the name of Dovie Rowntree. There's going to be a film made about her in probably in the next year or two. Crump was acquitted, but he was so traumatized by what had happened is that he created a career in crime for himself and had a very, very difficult life and actually died several years ago.
You're claiming Mary kept a diary, which is now the point of contention. Her home had been broken into with the apparent reason to find her writings, and after her death, the diary mysteriously disappeared. What do you know, if anything, about the diary's content and that would have made it so important for U.S. intelligence agency like the CIA or its chief, James Angleton, who in fact, as you mentioned, was the godfather of Mary's sons, to get their hands on it and tell us about how you traced its whereabouts?
Well, you have to remember that the CIA was already watching Mary. Her phone was tapped. This is Angleton spilled that little piece of information to another CIA wife some years later. One account has a FBI surveillance operation going on Mary right after the Warren Commission came out, because they were, of course, very worried about what her reaction was going to be. And Mary was a journalist. I mean, when she got out of college, she was a journalist. She had kept a diary before. Diary keeping was not new to her. And so she had actually confided in her best friend, Ann Truitt, that she was keeping a diary. And she had told Ann and Ann's husband, Jim Truitt, about the affair. And she said, look, if anything ever happens to me, I want you to, you know, make sure my diary is safe and doesn't fall into the wrong hands. So, you know, Jim Angleton and his cronies already know about this. So at the night of the murder, they get in, Jim Angleton, and I believe Ben Bradley, go into Mary's painting studio to look for the diary. It's not clear whether they found it there or whether Angleton found it later that night in Mary's bedroom in her house. But according to another CIA friend of Angleton's by the name of Bob Crowley, who read the diary as well, he told a particular friend of his that all the information was in there, that Mary had figured out what had happened in Dallas. It was very explosive material. There were stories that she had written in the diary about some of her use of marijuana and LSD with JFK, things like that. Now, what happened after the murder is that they invented the fact that the diary had been found the very next day. And it was actually, what they had found was an artist sketchbook. It wasn't really a diary. There were a few cryptic notes in that sketchbook that related to Mary's relationship with JFK. But it wasn't anything that was all that intelligible, at least according to what Ben Bradley told me in an interview that I did with him in 2009. So I believe that this sketchbook was really a ruse, that Angleton had actually made off with the real diary on the night of the murder. And, of course, he kept it to himself as best he could.
Who do you believe, besides whoever killed her, you suspect, but you have no hard evidence that the killer was William Mitchell?
No, the killer was not William Mitchell. I no longer believe that Mitchell was the actual assassin. I do believe that Mitchell was part of the assassination team.
Okay. Who do you believe was the killer?
I don't know.
All right.
I don't know.
Okay. So all these people who you claim were jogging that were part of a CIA actual operation could have been just people jogging and not a part of any operation. They could have been completely innocent also.
Well, sure. Anything's possible. But, Gary, you know, when you look at how Mary was killed, I mean, the gunshots were performed with surgical precision. The first shot was fired on the left side of her head, traversing the from left to right. The second shot was angled slightly under her right shoulder, angled slightly to the left. It severed her aorta immediately, killing her instantly. I mean, this was a skilled assassin, whoever this person was. I think he expected that the first shot would have killed her, but it didn't. She kept struggling, and she kept screaming. But the second shot certainly killed her. And then, of course, the murder weapon disappears. Now, no one who knew the alleged assailant, Ray Crump, had ever seen him with a gun. No one in his family, no one in his community. Ray Crump never owned a firearm, and yet they wanted to so badly pin the murder rap on Mr. Crump. And it was just a farce. The whole trial was a farce. And were it not for the skill of this incredible African-American woman, Dovie Rountree, I dare say Ray Crump would have likely been convicted.
Okay, besides Angleton, the head of the CIA, others who may have been behind Mary's assassination were her former husband, CIA top officer Cord Meyer, and her brother-in-law, Benjamin Bradley, who was vice president at large at the Washington Post and was managing editor for a long time. What evidence is there for implicating any of these people? Go through Ben Bradley at the Washington Post. He's the one who green-lighted the Woodward and Bernstein team on Deep Throat. And also Cord Meyer, her former husband.
Well, the interesting thing about Mr. Bradley's role is, first of all, I don't believe Bradley had any knowledge that this was going to take place. An operation of this magnitude is very highly compartmentalized, and only the people on a need-to-know basis would have been kept in the know, and that of course would include, you know, the actual assassination team. The interesting thing here is that on the day of the murder, Ben Bradley gets a call from none other than my father. And this is shortly after the murder has taken place. And it was about, the murder took place at about 12:25, a little after 2 p.m., my father calls Ben Bradley at his office at the Washington, at Newsweek, actually, where he was working. And he says, "Ben, are you listening to the radio?" And Ben says, "You know, Wister, I'm at work. Why would I be listening to the radio?" He said, "Well, there's a woman that's been murdered, you know, down on the towpath. And by the sound of it, it could be Mary. Do you know where Mary is?" And, of course, Bradley had no inkling of where Mary was, but it started to send shockwaves, at which point the story goes that, you know, Bradley rushed home, and the police show up at Bradley's house later on that afternoon, late afternoon, early evening, and say, "You know, Mr. Bradley, I think we may have your sister-in-law in the morgue. Would you come down and identify her to make sure that we're right about this?" And, of course, it was. But the question is why would my father be calling up Ben Bradley at the time that he did and giving him this information? And I maintain in my book that this was all part of the operation, that this is how the CIA would control an operation of this magnitude. By 2 o'clock, the deputy coroner had already been to the crime scene, had pronounced Mary dead. Ray Crump was in custody. He was about to be moved downtown to the police, and the next thing to do was to, you know, start to alert certain people of what had taken place. The police didn't know who Mary Meyer was until Ben Bradley identified her at 6 o'clock that evening. But Wister Janney, my father, calls Cord Meyer, who conveniently happens to be away that day in New York, calls him in the late afternoon and says, "Cord, you know, Mary's been shot." And, of course, Cord feigns a lot of surprise. This is written in Cord's book, Facing Reality. He tells a little story of my father calling him that day. So it appears to be nice and neat and tidy, except that when Wister Janney, my father, goes home that evening, he doesn't mention to my mother, you know, when he comes home, what happened that day. He waits. He waits until a phone call comes after dinner. Allegedly, the phone rings, and it's the police on the other end of the line, although we don't know for sure. But it's that point he calls out to my mother to ask her to come down to the living room and tells her what had happened. And, of course, my brother, who is home, I'm away at boarding school, my brother remembers this story and remembers this experience very clearly because he was there. So you can see that there are these little layers of intrigue going on in terms of how this entire event was controlled. And this, again, is part of the information that I maintain qualifies this as a full-bore CIA assassination operation.
What I find extraordinary in a rather synchronous manner was the parallel lives and characteristics between Cord Meyer and Jack Kennedy, including the life paths they followed on their journeys into Washington, and then to see how each moved into completely opposite directions, and then to find a single woman who was intimately involved with each. It's an extraordinary circumstance that Mary's former husband, Cord Meyer, would also have been involved in the killing of the president based on E. Howard Hunt's confession to his son. Speak a little about Kennedy and Cord Meyer's parallel lives, and then what else can you share about Cord's CIA operative actions?
Well, you know, Cord Meyer is a fascinating study. That's one of the most, I think, intriguing chapters in my book, because Cord is just brilliant. He was a star student while he was at Yale as an undergraduate. You know, he graduated winning the Alpheus Snow Award at Yale. That's Yale's highest honor. he worked very hard as a student. He graduated summa cum laude, and he was really a pacifist at that time. But when Pearl Harbor came, Cord felt that, you know, he had to do his part. So he went off and enlisted in the Marine Corps. And he goes out into the Pacific, and he's wounded. He's nearly killed, but he loses an eye, and he comes back, and he realizes that he's made a huge mistake, and that the province of war for Cord is just, it's an anathema. This has got to be stopped, particularly as we've just begun to enter the nuclear age. So this is when Cord and Mary Pinchot, who becomes Mary Pinchot Meyer, you know, start to get involved, because Mary was an ardent pacifist. She came from a very progressive, well-to-do, wealthy family out of New York, and she had been, in a sense, fostered at a very early age to really nurture herself and her independence. And, you know, her mother was a writer. Her father was a lawyer. He was one of the founders of the ACLU. Very progressive family. But this is how Mary becomes very attractive to Cord. And the two of them become the sort of, you know, post-World War II glamour couple. Cord is a rising star. He becomes head of something called the United World Federalists, which is very similar to the UN in terms of wanting some kind of supranatural government bureaucracy that can, you know, somehow act as the world's policeman and keep, you know, wars from starting. But there was a period where the United World Federalists was really catching on in the late 1940s. But then, because of what was going on with the rise of communism and Russia and Stalin, people got scared. And Cord realized, I think, that the days of that organization were numbered. And Cord got very depressed. He's already, like many of his, you know, World War II buddies, you know, somewhat alcoholic. He becomes more so. He doesn't know what to do. He doesn't have really the kind of courage he could have in terms of just declaring himself as a writer. He certainly wasn't hurting for money. He could have easily supported his family, given the background he came from. But he meets Alan Dulles. He gets seduced by Alan Dulles into the CIA. And this is exactly the kind of man that Alan Dulles wants in the CIA. And he's given all sorts of promises of a high rank. And this really starts the end of their marriage, because Mary begins to find out what the CIA is really up to. And she is no longer Cord's colleague, because Cord cannot tell her what he is really up to. So this starts to put a real wedge in their relationship. Mary is already aware of JFK because they met back in 1936 at a prep school dance that Mary attended when she was 15 years old. And JFK was immediately entranced with Mary when he first met her. She happened to be William Atwood's date, who most of your listeners will probably know that William Atwood became part of JFK's administration. But at the time, JFK was a couple of years ahead of Atwood at Choate. JFK comes back to Choate after he's graduated to attend the winter festivities weekend, and his eyes latch on to Mary Meyer, the Saturday night dance, and he can't take his eyes off of her. He cuts in repeatedly, and this really upsets Bill Atwood.
Okay, I don't want to go any further on this,
okay,
because it's more information in that area we need. I'd like to address two final parts.
Okay.
To this day, the U.S. government continues to conceal documentation on the JFK assassination and subsequent CIA murders. In 2000, a special committee of archivists at the National Archive convened with the intent to release more documentation to the public. However, intelligence threats silenced this effort, so there remains important documents that have not come to light. Moreover, the major media has been completely silent about Mary Meyer's murder and her influence upon JFK. what you believe are the primary reasons for the media blackout on her, particularly concerning Ben Bradley, and now our national security apparatus.
Well, I mean, I think it's pretty clear. I mean, the CIA doesn't, the CIA and Ben Bradley do not want the truth of this story to come out. I mean, I caught Ben Bradley in a very conspicuous lie. You know, in 1995, Bradley writes his memoir and says that he never went to Mary's studio until the day after the murder. But, you know, Bradley testifies at the trial in July 1965 that he was inside of Mary Meyer's studio on the night of the murder. I mean, this is just a blatant lie on his part. And he tells the prosecutor that he had no trouble getting into the studio, whereas in his memoir, 30 years later, he says he has to pick the lock because he didn't have the key. Now, this is really a gross inconsistency in his testimony, and I just find it uncanny that Mr. Bradley would be claiming this kind of a fish story, given that he has given testimony under oath in a courtroom that he was inside the studio on the night of the murder. It's things like that that really start to tarnish the reputation of someone like Ben Bradley. And, of course, it opens the door to many of the unanswered questions about what really happened.
One other question related. When JFK and Mary Meyer were having their long affair, and different from other affairs that he had, we have been led to believe that it was their intention, once and all brokered through Jack Kennedy, John Kennedy's father, that Joseph Kennedy, I should say, that once he had finished his supposed two terms in office, that they intended to get married. He intended to divorce Jackie. What evidence is there, if any, to support that, or is it just a rumor?
No, that actually came from Leo DeMoor. Leo DeMoor, the author Leo DeMoor, shared that piece of information with me. He was personal friends with Kenny O'Donnell, who was JFK's closest assistant. And Kenny O'Donnell confided in Leo DeMoor shortly before his death that JFK had been very much in love with Mary Meyer, and he had told Kenny O'Donnell in the fall of 1963 that after he got out of office, he really wanted to divorce Jackie so that he could be with Mary. And I don't think, you know, this is something that Mr. DeMoor would have made up. I mean, Leo DeMoor was passionate about this story, and I credit Mr. DeMoor with doing the real spade work in terms of starting to open up, to crack the armor of how Mary Meyer's life was actually terminated.
Final question. We have focused upon JFK's mistress, the people in her life, the people who decided that it was best that she be eliminated because she was intelligent, she had resources, she had a lot of contacts with the highest level of the inner circle, from the CIA and other agencies of government. She could pick up a phone and reach a lot of people that the average person, including top reporters, could not.
Correct.
That made her extremely dangerous.
Yes.
And because they didn't know what she knew, or they might have broken in, read her diary, and realized this isn't about her having an affair. This is about her saying something that she has found out from someone. Because the probability is that in her investigation after she saw the Warren Commission was a sham, she felt it was necessary to set the record straight, and she probably got in touch with some people who knew the truth, and she had written that out. That would have been the likely motive for them wanting to kill her. At any point, did you find who, and the rest of our series is going to delve into this part, who was behind the assassination? In Washington, in Dallas, in New Orleans, because we know they were in all three places. Did you have any luck in finding any of these connecting pieces, or is all your work based upon her association with Kennedy and getting rid of her? Because anyone who got rid of her would have had to have been connected with the original assassination.
Well, you know, I think as a student of the assassination, you know, I have studied this, you know, for close to 20 years. And I think the best book that's come out about the Kennedy administration and what actually took place is James Douglas's book, JFK and the Unspeakable. I mean, Mr. Douglas has just so thoroughly researched this in such a credible way that I think, you know, it's very clear on the basis of factual evidence that this was a bona fide coup d'etat that implicated the highest levels of government. That would include the CIA, the FBI, the U.S. Secret Service. And so I just think that the facts, the real facts in this case, only support the fact that there was this pervasive conspiracy to get rid of JFK.
I would agree with that. It was 2 years in the making, and the rest of this series will lay out who the people were. We'll be naming the shooters. We'll be giving the other part of the story. But we appreciate the piece of the puzzle that you have provided with us today. Thank you very much, Peter Janney, for sharing this with us.
Great to be with you, Gary, and thank you for having me.
Peter Janney is a scholar, and he is the son of a senior top career CIA official, Y-Star Janney. And his family were intimately involved with many of Washington's social and political elite, including close friends with CIA top official Cord Meyer, whose wife Mary Pinochet Meyer would become President John F. Kennedy's mistress and close confidant. And they were also close with most of the top people in Washington, D.C. I'm Gary Knoll. Thank you all for listening. I look forward to sharing more on our next program.